Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we hack weird and wonderful science launched into your ears. I'm Ian Wolf. On this packed edition, Kim Hewlett talks about hacking sex. Afterwards, Citizen Space. Hacking sex. Kim Hewlett is the co-founder and CEO of Next Biosciences in South Africa, and she's also a faculty member of Singularity University, South Africa. I began by asking Kim, you gave a talk at the Singularity University Australian Summit titled Hacking Sex and Playing God.
It's quite a provocative title, which can generate a lot of interest and gave a lot of thought on the ethics. In the 1960s, sex was decoupled from reproduction. So with the introduction of birth control, it was a sexual revolution and people no longer had to worry about making a baby when having sex. And now there's a new revolution upon us and reproduction is decoupled from sex and people no longer have to have sex to make a baby. And babies can now be made in a lab, and that's where I started unpacking that through reproductive technologies and how it's progressed over the decades.
So there's a lot of things going on, aren't there? There's everything from better contraceptive pills to contraception for men to assisting people who are having trouble with fertility. So where do you start with all of that?
So it really started off, I think the big revolution came when we were able to introduce IVF, which is in vitro fertilization. Fertilization happens in a lab by combining an egg and sperm. And that the first baby was born through IVF 41 years ago, Louise Brown. And at the time, it was seen as highly controversial and people questioning the meaning of human life and our own sexual, you know, existence. And the funny thing is that in the decades that followed, millions of babies have been conceived using IVF and everyone is just fine. You know, everyone's born healthy, doing great. But that has progressed and led us to develop other technologies from there. And that's where we are moving towards now with genetic testing. So in the past, well, how it's always been happened. So you create your embryos and it is really just potluck in IVF, like which embryo you choose. And round about only a third are ever healthy. So the chances of choosing a chromosomally like defunct embryo to transfer is quite high. And it results in a lot of people miscarrying or maybe having a baby with a serious genetic disorder. So we can now do genetic testing, high level, just to make sure that they're enough, the correct number of chromosomes. And then you can choose the healthy embryos for transfer, reduce the risk of miscarriage and eliminate, you know, baby with a serious genetic disorder. So that's where it's moving. Genetic testing to select the right embryo for disease. That's really where we are now.
So are we heading towards the scenario in the movie Gattaca, where they only picked the absolute healthiest ones and got rid of even the ones that had the slightest potential for anything else and restrict the population?
So that's where the technology is moving, of course. And it is very important to distinguish between selection of embryos and genetic engineering of embryos. So we're still in the first stage. So where we are, we can select for disease, but science is already moving towards where we can start selecting for traits. And people like Dr. Craig Fent, who sequenced the first human genome, has said that he can already generate a picture of what your baby will look like at 18 years old from a five-day-old embryo. So we are moving toward the trait. So that brings, obviously, with it a lot of ethics. And then the other side is the actual, if your embryos that you have don't carry the traits that you're looking for. Okay, that's where we get into engineering. And that's a completely different minefield and brings up a lot of ethical discussion, because by editing the DNA of an egg, sperm or embryo, it is possible to pass those genetic fixes onto future generations. And that's the issue, because how do you know that gene editing by fixing one issue is not going to inadvertently cause another issue. That's the whole, it's a big debate there.
And of course, that was the issue with those CRISPR babies in China.
Correct. That is exactly the issue. And look, and there has been talk that he didn't really edit the CCR5 gene to confer innate resistance to get HIV. It was actually to increase intelligence. We'll never know. And there are, it is known in scientific circles that apparently, can't say for sure, that many more such experiments have already happened in China and results awaiting publication. So,
do you think they'll publish now that they've sort of got wrapped on the knuckles for this one?
That'll be interesting. I think some scientists, ethics is an interesting question because it's deeply personal. So ethics depends, it's highly depending on where you are, what you perceive morally to be right from a religious perspective. So people have diverse opinions on that. So I think if there are scientists that really believe they're moving forward in the interest of science for medical reasons, I think just even from the acknowledgement perspective, I think papers will be published.
And so what's the next controversy?
I think it's going to be by people coming forward to admit that either they have selected or edited embryos for designer traits. So to make yourself... So disease is easier to overcome because you can understand, like no one really wants... You don't want to be burdened with a terrible disease that is a huge burden. And I'm not saying any disease is wrong because you can have the most magnificent children that have a certain disease. But I think that's easier to kind of accept. The thing that people cannot get their heads around is like choosing or editing for what they assume a designer trait, better intelligence, better looks, better athletic ability. Like there's a number of things. So I think that's going to be an issue.
And so what are the other reproductive technological issues?
Maybe I should chat to you about other reproductive technologies that are coming online for the future. So I discussed three today. The one I think that gets everyone very interested is a new emerging technology called IVG, okay, which would make IVF, everyone freaks about IVF, but IVG would make it look very quaint. And it's called in vitro gametogenesis. And it's where scientists, and this is only in the future, okay, so don't everyone get overexcited or freaked out, but it is in the future where you can take your skin cells and the scientists can convert that into stem cells and from there re-engineer that into lab-grown egg and sperm, which means that people that are infertile or struggling to conceive can now actually have babies, and even adults with no sperm and egg can conceivably have children. So in the future, we can imagine new kinds of families, like two men can have a baby that's biologically related to both of them, taking the skin cells from the one, creating an egg and fertilizing the sperm from the other, or one-parent babies. And as I said, like even, for example, a woman could make her own baby by taking her skin cells, creating a sperm and fertilizing her egg. And this would be more like a non-identical twin than a clone. So that's quite a freaked out thing. We also, another technology that's happening at the moment, it's where you take the DNA of three adults to make a healthy baby. So nuclear DNA comes from the mother and father, and there's mitochondrial DNA that's outside the nucleus of the cell. And this comes only from the mother and is responsible for generating 90% of the energy required by the child to sustain life. And sometimes it's faulty and it can be devastating. And now, like in the UK, they've just allowed you to use this technology. So what happens is if the mother has an egg with faulty mitochondria, you can extract her nucleus and replace that into a donor egg with healthy mitochondria, which is then fertilized by the sperm from the dad. And this has allowed people like this to have healthy babies, which has been amazing for them. The mitochondrial DNA is only like 0.01, or it's very tiny proportion of the DNA. So it make it sound a lot more controversial than it really is. It contains only a very tiny, tiny amount of DNA from the donor. And then another interesting technology is that of artificial wombs. It's already possible for a preterm fetus to survive outside the mother's womb from about 22 weeks of gestational age. And as you can imagine, it could be quite liberating for some woman not to have to carry a baby around for 9 months.
Well, that would get rid of all the problems about surrogacy.
That's also true. Exactly. So there is, and it would depend. So that would be outside of 22 weeks. And for those people interested, I mean, there was a satirical novel published in 1932 called Brave New World, where, it was amazing. They predicted 600 years into the future. And it described a society in the year 2040 where the population was grown in vats and in impersonal hatchery, and the embryos were graded into 5 tiers of intelligence created through the chemical treatment of these embryos. And there were no parents as such. Families are considered obsolete, and these babies are tended to by workers in white overalls. And the crazy thing is, even though this book was written 600 years into the future, we're not even 100 years in, and we're already moving from science fiction to fact.
Well, he also predicted contraception, didn't he?
He did, yes. So, I mean, well, as we know, hey, the best way to achieve the future is to, well, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Exactly. You know, all of this, it does freak people out. It's quite, and the big a big question around this comes is like, is it ethical to choose? Or is it ethical? Is it not ethical? Is it unethical not to choose? You know, it brings up a lot of interesting debate. So, you know, you can imagine a future where, you know, we do try to give our children the very best in life, the very best upbringing, education, clothing, food, and why not let them start off with the best genetic code? You know, is it heresy or is it just common moral sense? And I think it's a very deeply personal question, as I mentioned earlier. You know, ethics is, it's a wide topic.
I think part of the issue for people is if you have a child now and then you try to do the best for them, you're doing the best for the child after they're born. Whereas in this case, you're choosing which child gets born, and the child with some potential for physical health problems that may never eventuate doesn't get born.
Correct. And that's what makes it very hard. So, sure, and I can talk on that for ages. And the one interesting thing is, which I mentioned, is even if you do choose the so-called perfect genes, if you could have that option, it doesn't guarantee you the child of your dreams, because in a study of identical twins, it is proven that genetics is only responsible for 20 to 30% of whom we become. And it's largely dependent on epigenetic factors like lifestyle and environment. So, and as scientists, I mean, we're not even anywhere close to understanding what all the genetic data means and which genes are responsible for which traits. So we still really got a very long way to go. So people shouldn't get freaked out. It's like, it's possible, but it's still quite a long way off before we even get there. And even if you choose those right genes, it doesn't mean that that's what you're going to get.
Well, see, I suppose the other side of that is genetic therapy after you've been born to correct whatever problems you might have inherited.
Ah, interesting. Yes, I'm sure that that'll also come along in the future. Exactly. The one other interesting thing I think in all of this is, you know, we focused on ensuring we choose the, you know, the genetically healthy embryos. And if you, I gave the example, there are couples that are deaf and have deliberately chosen embryos with the deafness gene because they want children that are the same as them. So there isn't any right or wrong. And in other pockets of society, there have been children that have been petitioning against embryo selection because if there was, they wouldn't have been born because they carry some sort of disease. It's a fascinating field. It's a minefield, in fact.
And how does this relate to what you do with your work?
So what we do in Johannesburg in South Africa is we do reproductive genetic testing. So we only focus on screening embryos for diseases. So you can do a high-level screen for chromosomes to ensure it's the correct number. And if you come from a family with a history of a certain genetic illness that is like can be devastating, you can undergo carrier screening to establish the risk of passing this on to your children. And then you can then undergo genetic testing of your embryos so that we can identify which embryos do not carry that disease or condition, and then ensure that that does not get passed on to your children or future family generations. And I think that's quite amazing, because some families have been just burdened with terrible, terrible genetic diseases that are debilitating. And I know of some people like this, and they've just refused to have children because they don't want to pass on that same, that have their child live with that. And it's actually sad sometimes, because maybe they didn't inherit the gene, their child might not inherit it, and they could actually go forward and have beautiful, gorgeous children. So yeah, it's a fascinating field.
And gene sequencing has become cheaper and faster and better. So that's got to change things as well.
No, absolutely. So the sequencing costs have plummeted significantly, and I think they're still going to plummet more. And as the cost of genetic sequencing comes down even more, I mean, it is, people talk about it, that every single baby will have their genetic, you know, their genome sequenced at birth, so we can start understanding what is going to be the future for this child. And even that in itself is another whole ethical debate. Like, would the child want to know that? Should the parents be doing that? Anyway, that opens a whole... So some people are performing genome sequencing on babies, but really the only thing that will be reported back is kind of if they're at risk of any disease in the next few years. They don't kind of map out, you know, way past that into the future.
I know that in Australia, they're doing a little pinprick for newborns and getting a little blood sample at birth to go with all the other records for a very long time.
Correct.
How long would those be viable to be sequenced?
So what the pinprick you're talking about is known as, we call it newborn screening. So it's like metabolic screening. And there it's just being run through a machine to test how the baby's reacting to certain proteins or carbohydrates that they can digest. And if you don't pick those up early enough, those consequences can be devastating and cause brain damage and even in some cases be fatal. And those are simple things that you can actually prevent right up front. So if you can see that your baby's lacking some certain protein and it can't metabolize protein or carbohydrate or fat, you can actually, just through intervening on the diet, like change that whole child's trajectory into the future. So I think newborn screening is an amazing test to have and something that every parent should consider. I think that we're entering into a very exciting, fascinating field, and it's a discussion that we should all be having, because as we said, it's no longer a science question, it's going to become a society question. And how do we ensure that everyone has their personal rights, freedom, liberty, and balance that with the social consequences?
Well, Kim, thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure, Ian, and thank you for having me on your show, your podcast. Thank you.
That was Kim Hewlett talking about hacking sex and playing God at the Singularity University Australia Summit. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com.
This is a story of the future, but not the very distant future. It is a story that might have taken place the day after tomorrow. Like all stories of the future, however, its beginnings lie far back in the past. As far back as the first man on Earth to gaze at the stars and wonder if someday, somehow, he might travel to them. Travel through space. The work went on.
Space for the rest of us? Stephen Brinks is the founder of Citizen Space, a space agency for hobbyists who want to launch something. I met Stephen at the Consumer Electronics and Business Information Technology CBIT conference at Darling Harbour. I began by asking him what is Citizen Space?
Citizen Space is a civilian-run space agency, and we're open sourcing space to give everyone access to build something, design something, and actually put it in space.
So is this for entrepreneurs or hobbyists?
It's for hobbyists and groups and students and existing rocketry clubs. It's like a hybrid rocketry club, and we're bringing a whole network of people together from all around the world to work on one project. And that gives us strength, like it acts like a filter to get rid of the silly ideas and essentially to put all our minds together to work on the good ideas and to make the project successful.
So traditionally, people build model rockets to send them up into the sky, but you're going to help them send it to space.
Yes, yeah, space. So we believe the technology's out there and the prices come right down that even civilians can come together to fund it as a club. So, you know, you pay your $100 membership for the year, just like any other club, and the members are the investors. So all that money goes together towards that project.
Is there a lot of licensing involved to send something into space?
Yeah, there is red tape, but there's ways to do it with the Australian Aviation. Yeah, no, there's all the licensing is there and available for us to launch hot rockets.
Have you spoken to the new Australian Space Agency?
Not yet. We're taking subscriptions. We've got hundreds of subscribers, and on the 1st of 2020, we open for memberships. When we get the numbers, that's when we'll reach out to universities and big business for sponsorship and get things off the ground.
And where would you launch from?
There's a few places, one in Queensland and South Australia. So we'll see what the members want to do and where they actually want to launch it from and who wants to get involved.
Because there used to be a group, I think OzRock or something, that were sending something up. And your name?
Vinith. I'm from the UNSW rocketry team. And yeah, so that company was called OzRocketry. And yeah, so they used to build big rockets and send it to space to the Von Karman line. And that's usually done from like Queensland. So like inner west of Brisbane, about 6 hours drive. So, but there are other sites in like Perth, Melbourne, South Australia. There's one in New South Wales, but not as high in sky clearance because of CASA approval. But yeah.
So I guess all those people who had to stop doing that would want to come and join.
Yeah, well, I think the way technology's going, with like even the simple stuff, Arduino and quadcopters and robotics and even STEM in schools, this is the way it's all going to space.
With CASA wanting to crack down on quadcopters and drones for some reason, do you think they're going to be harsh with people sending things all the way up?
I think they will, but these kind of things only last for a few days before they come back down. But we haven't seen any drone highways in the sky yet, so I think there's still plenty of sky.
With time comes change, I guess. It's a way forward for Australian rocketry.
Well, surely, if the Australian government wants people to start space businesses, you have to get experience in space, and the only way to do that is to send something up.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the space sector is growing a lot, and there's a lot of big announcements for 2020. And essentially, it's Space 2.0.
I would talk over there to the University of Western Sydney people. They're talking about neuromorphic cameras detecting stuff in space, and they want to send some stuff up. So they might be people to partner with.
Yeah, we'll talk to them. And we're doing some presentations at the observatories and stuff like that. So you'll see us around. Just remember when you're watching the fireworks for the new year, that Citizen Space is starting, and so hop on and tell us what you would build and put in space.
And where would people find you online?
Just on citizenspace.net.
Well, Stephen and Vinith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Stephen and Vinith of Citizen Space. You can find out more at citizenspace.net. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion?
Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border Districts of Victoria and South Australia. City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.